happened while you slept? We have the answer. Bill Bennett's Morning in America.
Welcome back to Morning in America. It's Steve Hayward sitting in for Bill Bennett today, and we're covering the whole waterfront, from President Obama's announcement on new gun restrictions to the news breaking overnight that North Korea maybe has a hydrogen bomb, to the stories out of Europe about immigrants, quote-unquote, harassing women throughout Germany, more than just harassing. We want to take time in this segment, however, to talk about energy for a moment. We want to do it with one of our favorite energy experts. It's Mark Mills, senior fellow from the Manhattan Institute, the CEO of the Digital Power Group. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
Morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, I have to do a little bit of comedy with you, I suppose. I spotted a story in a British newspaper a couple of days ago. I forget who wrote it, but some knucklehead who's saying, gosh, low gasoline prices are terrible. I just love the way that nothing can ever be right with a certain cast of mind. When high gasoline prices are high, it's the energy industry and ExxonMobil gouging us. And when gasoline prices are low, darn that dreaded free market, we're going to ruin the planet. I mean, you just can't win, can you?
You can't win with the oil haters. There is a cabal that just thinks that petroleum is evil. And, you know, it's kind of ironic. We have to give George Bush, President Bush, in Bush 43, the credit for calling our use of oil an addiction, which is real sad. So much for rationale on oil. Oil is as much an addiction as oxygen is an addiction.
Yeah, I noticed that just about every human being I can think of is addicted to food in the same way, right? I mean, yeah, that was not one of President Bush's finer rhetorical moments. Well, let me brag on you a little bit and put you on the spot a little bit, I suppose. I know you've long said that only a fool predicts oil prices, and I understand that. I agree. On the other hand, I do remember you calling years ago, 8 or 9 years ago, when we first met, that there was a gas glut coming, And sure enough, natural gas today is the cheapest it's ever been in the United States, adjusted for inflation, right? And I think you also said, look, oil supply is going to go up because of the way technology is happening. So it seems to me you deserve a victory lap despite your modesty. But with that preface, what do you see ahead of us here? What do your instincts tell you? What's your spidey sense say?
You're absolutely right. Predicting prices, are good at predicting prices. They're really good at it. I'd be an oil trader, a very successful one, and I'd own stations that you're speaking on. It would be, but you can get the general trajectory right. It's not that hard. So we already know that the low prices create some supply destruction. That's just how these cycles work. Oil is a cyclical product. I mean, this has been true for 120 years, and it hasn't changed. So when it's low, this is really easy. It's going to get more expensive. When it's expensive, it'll get cheaper again.
Right.
The challenge, of course, is how long it takes for each cycle and how deep the cycles are. And in cycle depth, there's a lot of problems. When it peaks and gets too high because of, I don't know, wars, all kinds of things that happen that are unsustainable, politicians are really unhappy. Right? They're jumping off bridges when oil gets really expensive.
Right.
And when it gets really low, of course, they don't care very much about helping, as you say, the oil industry. And then we have bankruptcies and consolidation. Look, it's my spidey sense is pretty easy because I ask guys who are experts. The demand is going to keep rising. Oil is an irreplaceable, critical global commodity. And we're going to add to the world consumption equal to adding the United States over the next 20 years. So there's an amazing amount of oil demand coming.
Which is what? We do about, 18 million barrels a day now, I think, something like that? Yeah.
And we're going to add about 20 million barrels per day of demand because of China, India, Vietnam. You know, the rest of the world is just growing, and they're buying cars. They're flying airplanes. Simple. And you can't replace oil in a significant way in those markets. And supply takes a lot of money and a lot of risk. And so when prices are low long enough, people pull back. You know, the investors pull back, and they have. So we now know that around 12 million barrels per day of new supply has been canceled globally. That's a really big number.
Right.
So at some point, how they say this, two curves cross again. Prices will start to rise. People will start flipping out again. And if you're an oil producer, you're hoping Mardi Gras comes back. And in a way, it will. But here's the big difference. I think the price gets capped, and we're going to go into an era of serial gluts. It gets capped because the American shale producers can enter the game so fast with so much oil that it'll start pushing prices back down pretty quickly once they start rising again.
Yeah, my perception is that the shale production that we've led the world in pioneering has barely started around the world, right? I mean, it seems to me there's large parts of the world where the shale revolution is in its first or second inning.
Yeah, and most of the world, it's they haven't got the base yet. They're you know, practice swings.
Right.
So we have I would say at least a 10-year lead in having the infrastructure and the skills developed and the technology mature enough in shale globally. There's shale everywhere. You're absolutely right, Steve. There's shale fields. We don't occupy a unique part of the geology of the planet, right? We occupy a unique part of the politics of the planet. In some ways good, in some ways recently not so good, I guess.
Right. Right. Do you think OPEC is broken forever?
I think it's not fully broken yet. I think it's half broken. You know, the wheels haven't come off the bus totally. It's got a flat tire.
Yeah,
but they're clearly influencing markets. Here's the flip side. You know, U.S. entrepreneurs have really changed the game. But when OPEC decided to increase production when prices were already low last year, that's what drove the prices even lower. So they have a capacity, you know, a single oligarch, in a sense, a single king could say, you know what, I'm really unhappy with these thousands of shale guys. Let's see if I can hurt them.
Right.
And cranks the spigot open, crashes the prices, because traders are traders, right? If there's more supply, the price goes down. So they're tinkering with the market. They still have the capacity to tinker with the market. So that's what makes it both interesting and dangerous. It's interesting because we've entered a new era. It's unlike the last 40 years. Everything about it's different. And I don't think everybody's really recognized that yet and have adjusted to it, both geopolitically and economically.
Yeah, I mean, the question you often read, it's the conventional one, but sometimes the conventional questions turn out to be right, I think, is whether low prices are going to squeeze Russia, Venezuela, Iran, the other OPEC producers before it completely clobbers Texas and North Dakota. Do you agree with that question, and do you have a sense of that?
Well, we know that some of the really the bad actors, so to speak, the Venezuelans of the world, are already squeezed and hurting like mad, and Saudi Arabia has already consumed nearly $100 billion of their sovereign wealth fund. They have a $750 billion in rainy day fund that they're tapping into to tolerate this. So this is my sense is we're going to see both things happen. We're going to see destruction, if you like, in production capacity around the world, both with the oligarchs and with the entrepreneurs. Both are going to happen.
Right.
That's already happening. The wild card is who comes back fastest, and I'm betting on American shale, and that's I think what scares the Saudis, and I know the Russians get this. By the way, the Russian oil minister already put out their worldview, which is oil stays cheap for a decade.
Right.
That's really quite a change.
One more question on this, and then we'll shift gears another direction. I don't know if you've seen the Wall Street Journal yet this morning, but there's an interesting story buried in the money and finance section about how the Saudis may remove the currency peg between the dollar and their currency, the rial. And that's one of those little stories that might pass by you quickly, but that would be a huge thing for their economy, I think. And you know, they've had the dollar rial peg for decades, but they have to prop it up with their dollar reserves they get from selling oil. That to me is a really big sign that they're in deep trouble already.
I think you're right. I mean, and in fact, that's part of what this sort of realignment that's going on. I don't think either the CIA or the Defense Department, including our Fed, have got wrapped their arms around. And when you have sovereign wealth funds, there's $6 trillion in sovereign wealth funds globally, and $4 trillion of that is in oil money. And those funds are now starting to decrease, not increase, starting to consume their capital. They're starting to go to debt markets. There's all kinds of sort of ripples spinning out from the shale fields that just like what's happening in Saudi Arabia. So I agree with you. It's a signal something's changed. It's pretty significant, and I think it's one of those sort of kind of like the tectonic plates, right? It's a really big deal, but it's hard to notice it initially.
Right. Let's shift gears here for a moment to nuclear power, which I don't follow that closely, but there are two things that are notable about it, I think. One is the number of environmentalists, often who say privately and not publicly, that they've changed their mind about nuclear power, and that's because of the climate change obsession they have. Yeah. And then the second thing is, you know, you read lots of stories, and I can never get to the bottom of them, that we have all these new technologies, you know, thorium reactors or, you know, just better and cheaper and simpler designs that we had 40 years ago. What's your reading? Are we going to see a nuclear renaissance, or is this just all still wishful thinking?
Well, I don't trust the environmentalists' claimed new love for nuclear power.
Right.
It's
not all of them, certainly, but it's a few. But
yeah, and there's some brave ones who will stand up. Look, the reality is that there's no single source of energy that is as expansive and impressive and phenomenologically different from anything in human history as is fission and nuclear energy. There's nothing comes close. I have no doubt in the long term there'll be a huge resurgence on the production and supply of nuclear energy. But in the short term, and by that I mean, I think, at least for a decade or more, China's going to lead the world in this. They're building more reactors than anybody else, which means they're developing the skills faster than anybody else in the world. So when the emerging markets start buying reactors, they're going to be buying the technology we pioneered that China is perfecting. And I would call that sort of the Gen 2 technology. Gen 1 was, you know, the dawn of the nuclear era of the 50s. Gen 2 is what's being built. Gen 3 is what's the equivalent of a Tesla in a nuclear power plant?
Right.
You know, and there's a lot of exciting possibilities. And the engineers have not even begun to maximize what you can do that would be exciting. But we're spending some money on it here, and I think America has a chance to be a leader in that. But this is that's definitely a deeply generational cycle. I would be stunned if we see it in our lifetime.
We've got about a minute left, and you know, we used to spend a lot of time when you and I'd have coffee talking about batteries. And you know, Bill Gates says for batteries to be any good, they have to be 100x better than what we have now, 100 times better. What's the latest on batteries, or what do you know about what's happening with batteries? Is there any optimism there?
Yeah, but I'm optimistic for different reasons than other people. So he's absolutely right. Batteries have to get roughly, you know, in terms of price, longevity, energy density, 100x better than they are today. Certainly at least 10x to be really useful and widespread for big energy uses like cars and power plants. But battery technology is making incredible leaps where it really matters. Because, you know, we're so likely running out of oil and gas, as we've talked about. So we need batteries. They don't buy you much. Yeah, electric cars are nice. Tesla's cool. The revolution is in how I power all this portable stuff without plugging it up and recharging it so often. How I make the Internet of Things happen requires a revolution in battery technology. At that level, it's coming, because there you can afford to pay for it, because you just need tiny amounts of energy. So you can pay a lot per unit of energy because you have tiny amounts. And there you can afford batteries that are 100 times more expensive because you're going to use 1,000 times less energy. And that revolution is enormous. It's been underappreciated, and it's probably the single biggest sort of trigger for a revolution in Internet of Things and all kinds of improvements in manufacturing and efficiency.
Right. Mark Mills, thanks very much for joining us. Sadly, we've run out of time, but I agree with and celebrate your optimism. It's Stephen Hayward sitting in for Bill Bennett on Morning in America. We'll be back after these messages.